what makes someone come to a place like this in the first place? What makes them stay? And crucially, what should we know? What do we have to ask ourselves about what makes people leave? These are vital questions for all of us. Those who plan on seeing a big chunk of this century in the books before we move on from this life to whatever's next, and for those of us who've lived most of our lives in the last century, when the mainline church could speak to America from an Olympian height, secure that it set America's religious thermostat. So the book will be an intergenerational dialogue across boundaries of lay and ordained men and women, two very different views of that distance between the celebrant at the altar and those waiting to come to the table. Sometimes when I talk to my kids about growing up in the 60s, it feels like trying to explain life on another planet. A vast gulf of time and change, rather than a simple explanation from parent to child. I had a brief moment in my life when I didn't have a beard, but it's been quite some time in the past now. A lot of things happened all at once in the last 60 years, and in an entwined way. So what we're facing now, demographic disaster, is not just something we did, where we can look at one thing that happened and say, oh, we did this and we shouldn't have done that. But a lot of things were happening all at once. But to have a healthy future, to be able to speak to ourselves and to the country from a healthy, honest, coherent place, we now have to ask important questions about belonging. To whom? To what do you belong? What recent decades have brought is a rapid redefinition of what it means to be with, to find, to be close to your people. For a lot of the country, the car-dependent life being built out on the perimeter of metropolitan areas meant your parish church was no longer a 10-minute walk from your front door, as it had been in so much of urban America. Now it meant getting in the car and either driving back to the old neighborhood or increasingly not going to church at all. Just as a test, how many of you sitting here grew up in this neighborhood and have lived here all your life? There we go. Makes my point beautifully, I think. We were no longer in each other's faces in quite the same way as we were in the mid-20th century. It's become, in many ways, a freer and more diverse country. Reinvention was now an available choice with very little social sanction. Not only could you choose something different for yourself than maybe your parents thought they could choose, but who would know? And who would care? And who would tell you that you couldn't choose that thing? People began to explore other ways of being a faithful person, free of the strictures, the rules, the obligations of family history. No one was expecting you. You could easily opt in and opt out. No one was going to miss you if you weren't at that new modern church building off a 6-lane suburban arterial with no masses in any language other than English, without the people you went from kindergarten through 12th grade with at your local elementary or parochial school. People had become, in a way they hadn't been in a long time, religious free agents. They began to raise families with other obligations on the weekend. And if your mother now had a full-time job, Saturdays and Sundays became not only precious family time, but also the packed agenda days to get done all those things that couldn't get done as easily during the week. All these changes, some big, some small, pressed on church. People at the same time were losing faith, losing trust, in all kinds of institutions, in elected officials, in government itself, in criminal justice, in the news business. And they began to declare, I'm making up my mind for myself. The very idea of authority, of surrendering a little bit of personal sovereignty to someone or something else, was becoming less desirable. Yeah, that's George Santos. was becoming less desirable, less attractive a way of being an adult. As we moved from the 20th into the 21st century, televisions kept getting bigger and movie theaters kept getting smaller. And that should tell you a great big truth about how and when we were getting in each other's faces. Or movie theaters disappeared altogether, as they did. We had like four or five in this neighborhood alone, and they're all gone. You watch movies with lots of people, many of them strangers. You watch TV often by yourself. And you may ask, why is he telling me all this? Where's he going? Well, again, to whom do you belong? Let's start with an exercise. Many of you have a spouse, and at least in a very fundamental way, your futures are tied, or at least that's what you promised in front of a bunch of other people. You got all dressed up, you said you would take care of this person, they said they would take care of you, and you either did it or you didn't, but that's a rant for another day. I belong to my wife in a way that's very practical. We own a house together. We ran that house together. We raised children together. We belong to each other in a way also that's less practical and more, let's say, mystical. Along with a material life, we raise children who belong to us and we belong to them in ways that I would submit are also day by day less practical and more emotional. They don't really need me for anything anymore, nothing tangible anyway. They now have only implied yet very well understood obligations to me and to Carol from here on out. No authority could compel them to take care of me if I was infirm. No court could order them to pay my debts. They couldn't be forced to take me to doctor's appointments or even listen to my complaining. They really are separated from me except by these invisible, strong cables that still keep us in each other's faces. And, you know, I did what I had to do as well, and most of it not under any particular legal requirement, but I did it. And we did a reasonably good job, and they're decent human beings. And I now am watching this happen with my father, who will turn 88 in a couple of weeks. And again, I can't be forced to do anything for him. And yet, I feel like I have to. You get that, right? I belong to my neighbors. Across the street, and next door to my left, and next door to my right, all lawyers. As a reporter, as a writer, I feel honored to integrate the neighborhood in the way that I do. We watch out for each other. We fed pets and picked up their Amazon deliveries and shared their joys and sorrows, funerals, threatening health crises, the arrival of children and grandchildren. We belong to each other, even if we might never say so. And finally, I belong to St. Columba's Episcopal Church, and I don't know all of you, or I don't know all of you equally well, but you are my people. You are my multi-generational, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, accidental, and only slightly dysfunctional family. I thought about this in a much deeper way when I was doing visits as part of the team that encouraged people to give to the Capital campaign. Some of the amounts of money that we were asking people for was kind of amazing to me, and yet we did it as if it was the most natural thing in the world. And the even weirder part was that people then turned around and gave us the money. Remarkable. Listening to all the reasons, the explanations, the histories people gave for being part of this church made me think about belonging a lot. I give money, I give time, and a much harder to define emotional deposit to this place over the years, year in and year out. You don't have to pass a test like Mensa. The promises that made me technically a member of this thing weren't even made by me. I was only 6 weeks old. They were made on my behalf by other people. If I stopped coming here, people would ask after me for a while. People don't get up in front of the congregation, bang on the altar, and storm out. Talk to any congregational leader, and they'll tell you people fade away more than stomp away in a lot of churches. Church moves from essential to optional to occasional to rare. A guy named Ryan Burge keeps great databases on church membership, and gradually over time, the proportions of weekly, sometimes, and never have been shifting inside the 100% of church attenders. Where else do I belong? I belong to alumni associations for two schools. I belong to the National Eagle Scout Association. I'm out of sync. Well, all right. And there I am. And though it's been 50 years since I got my Eagle Medal, if I disappeared from the organization's roles, I know I wouldn't be very much missed. I belong to the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And since my time as a Daily Deadline reporter is coming to a close, and the most active years of my career are most certainly over, why do I remain a member? Well, I support the organization's goals, and I like hanging out with my people. They're my people. That's a phrase that's going to come up a couple of more times. It isn't easy as it once was to find your people. It isn't as easy or as common to manage to hold together a tribe of friends over time. Men especially are finding it particularly difficult to keep old friends and find new ones. Not so long ago, they might have met up in a place like this. This is the Scottish Rite Masonic Lodge on 16th Street. Held together by fraternal bonds and cool secret rituals and the ability to wear interesting hats. Whatever works, you know? So where does that leave us? What's the implication for us all moving forward? What will you do with the freedom of choice that you might consider part of your inheritance as an American in the 21st century? What does it mean when it's all said and done to belong? Think about the nature of belonging in the 21st century. The still new world of the web creates a kind of instant familiarity that's both easily achieved and easily discarded. We pay a lot of attention to one and not enough attention to others. Any club that's really, really easy to join is also really, really easy to leave. So, you might be a gamer, or a skateboarder, or a quilter, or someone who dresses up and goes to Renaissance fairs. No judgment. But members of those online groups have very little allegiance to each other. You might talk to someone who says, yes, I have 3,000 Facebook friends. But if you looked at them all as a list, how many of them would you easily be able to identify from that tiny little picture that goes along with their profile? They wouldn't be aware of it if you disappeared from their list of friends quite often. The requirements for belonging are minimal at the front door, but what's expected of someone who belongs is often so minimal as to be non-existent. Algorithms have made the kind of content you might build belonging around come looking for you, even if you don't consciously go looking for it, which is another really important change about these groups of associations that we cobble together into something like an identity. So let's think about sticking long term. In this era of easy allegiance, weak social bonds, weak affiliation, weak obligation, what might a long-term, more nourishing relationship look like here and elsewhere? Is there something it would demand of you that you might not be willing to give? Fair question. If you learned the Apostles, Athanasian, or Nicene creeds as a kid, in school or in religious instruction, you may have memorized the words and gotten little added context when you were memorizing it. You were expected to learn them, to recite them, and there was a working belief that by saying them over and over, something might eventually penetrate into and become something more deep. You might even question whether these things are believable. I don't know if you saw Pope Leo recently with the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew. They were in Nicaea for the 1700th birthday of the Nicene Creed. People have lost the knack, as I mentioned before, for simply taking the word of big institutions and saying, when they believing it, when they say, this is the truth, so trust me. Hardly alone among religious institutions, but often in a 1,000-watt light, because after all, the single largest religious group in the United States, the Roman Catholic Church, they've had a tough 35 years. Absent Latinos, there would be significantly fewer Catholics in the United States than there are. And I know one major public official who sits up in his chair when he hears absent Latinos, but again, a rant for another day. It's been a time of testing, of trial, of shattered faith, and large numbers falling away. And it's hard to know how many would have found something else to do on Sunday morning, absent the scandal and sin that came to light. But two things happened at the same time, and they're hard to tease apart. Back to the creeds. Do you have to believe every word of the creed when you say it on Sunday? There's no right answer. Since I'm not a member of the clergy or an authorized spokesperson for the church, I'm allowed to tell you, I don't think so. You don't have to believe every word all the time in the same way every time you say it. Sometimes it's doubt that keeps you coming, and that's okay too. You may test the purity of the gold like a metallurgist pouring a little arsenic onto a sample. You may turn it over in your hand like an appraiser turning an antique over. I flew here from Newark this morning to tell you that's okay. Because the lifelong journey of figuring out what you believe and why you believe it is a restless enterprise. It never stands still. So you are emotionally, intellectually, physically, even now, even with a head full of white hair, a work in progress. You are not exactly who you were when you were 15. You are not exactly who you were when you were 45. And neither will you be the same at 95, God willing. Maybe you had a crisis of faith, went wandering, and then found your way back. Everyone's timeline is different. Everyone's reasons for being inside are different, just as where you'll end up might share some fundamentals and be demonstrably different from where you are today. I've never believed that we all have to land in the same place to be in the same room. And here we are. You're proving it by being here this morning. I am not a theologian. I'm a pretty ordinary workaday Christian who's thrilled when some readings come around in the lectionary cycle and maybe, truth be told, can do without some others. There are parts of the Bible, even now, that I've heard them countless times make a beeline straight from my heart and my head. And even if I'm not always sure about every word in the creed, that will always stay true till the day I die. I have often heard, and you probably have too, people say, yes, I grew up in the church, but now I don't need organized religion. Being out in nature is my church, or walking my dog is my church. Or sharing a meal with friends gets me to those same places the church does. Okay, you know, to echo the late Pope, who am I to judge? But there was a reason why we perfected a congregational model in the first place, and it wasn't just to make sure there would continue to be little Christians. It's because gathering a set of teaching and ideas about the world called the Way was never meant to be practiced in isolation. Yes, hermit saints, desert fathers, cool for them, not for you. And Jesus understood this too. He was immersed in the real world, talked about the sensual lived experience of touch and heat and tangy salt and dirty feet. People who fell short of faithfulness in marriage, who fall short in fair dealings between bosses and workers, of experiencing fabulously generous anointing that runs down your face and onto your beard. For those of you who've never had one, you have to imagine it with me. Getting the olive oil out of your beard is a task, but definitely worth it. My son, who after a lifetime of coming to church with me and continuing to go to church every week after he moved away from home to go to the University of Chicago, told me one day that he didn't think there was a God, but he revered Jesus and he loved church, and that's why he still went. And this was hard to hear. His son, my first grandchild, cute as hell, by the way, was born earlier this year. Born in New York because my son and his still new wife weren't sure they wanted to deliver in China where they live. I knew they would be with us only a few months before heading back to China. And I asked my son quietly on the side, didn't want to make a big thing out of it, during a family gathering, whether my grandson was going to get on that plane to go back to Shanghai baptized. Because baptism's not so easy to come by in China, especially for someone who holds an American passport, like this handsome young fella here. My daughter-in-law is an adult convert, a member of a below-the-radar, not government-approved house church movement. And I wasn't sure what my son's answer was going to be. And he said, well, I want to do it. Shanshan doesn't want to do it. And I was shocked. My agnostic son was all in on getting the kid baptized, but my serious Bible-studying daughter-in-law wasn't. I said, what gives? And he said, well, she's not sure she believes in infant baptism. I said, well, tell her this. Tell her it's our family's custom that the boy's grandfather and great-grandfather would be happy, that even the boy's stateside grandmother, my Jewish wife, would be pleased. And for good measure, hint that if it weren't done, he would never be absolutely sure, when I was in Shanghai, that they wouldn't come back from shopping to find the deed already done in the kitchen sink. And I was only half kidding. So she went for it, and the entire Suarez clan gathered from all up and down the East Coast. Shan Shan's friends from China and Taiwan were all on hand for the joyous occasion. And how cool is it to be baptized by your own aunt? Not possible when I was baptized, but now not as big a deal, I guess. We human beings love ritual, and that gathering earlier this year was a reminder of why. It's the mystical bond of what we mean to each other, made real and concrete. Now, some of my nieces and nephews are not churchgoers, but they remarked on how much they loved that service. If I went to every one of them individually, they might have a slightly different explanation for just what we were doing with this beatifically sleeping, cute as anything, two-month-old, in the baptism gown worn by every member of the Suarez family baptized for the last 65 years. Some would have attached no importance to it all as function, bringing this perfectly innocent little boy into our thing by ritually having him die to sin. Some might have attached little significance to repeating the baptismal vows. Others were getting a kick out of just us being all together. I still think it's very important to hold on to what got us through 2,000 years, to insist that we be more than just the club of nice people. And of all the dangers that's waiting out there in the rest of the century for the church, God forbid that we just become the club of nice people. Now, don't get me wrong, many of you are very nice. Others need a little work. But I also feel that the church, capital T, capital C, in the largest definitions of that phrase, cannot afford, in a world of weakening social ties, of greater mobility, of doing my own research, of being the captain of my own ship, that the church cannot afford to be too doctrinaire and too choosy about who's in and who's out. And this is going to be a challenge for us moving forward, because we've had very specific rules about who's in and who's out in our past. And when in the parable of the workers in the vineyard, Jesus reminds his followers that the people who complained about the workers who showed up late in the day and still got a day's pay, they're the ones who are like you and me. To make it healthy and sound to 2100, we're going to have to throw open our arms to the world, spend less time excluding, more time including, and recognizing how deeply people need each other. How a walk in the woods is really great, but it isn't church. And let's be really clear about what the difference between those two things is. As a religious but not particularly spiritual person, making me very much out of step with the times, I live in my head to a greater degree than I should. I'll admit that. A few years ago, at this very occasion, my Advent talk, I was discussing both the nuts and bolts of my diagnosis and treatment for cancer. How the disease can rock you to your foundations, make you assess and question a lot of things about your life. After I was finished with the Q&A and getting very kind applause, Ledley asked me if I would stay for a blessing. And when he said that, I assumed he would pray for my continued recovery and I would sit down. But not this Sunday. Instead, he asked members of the congregation who felt so moved to come up to the front and lay their hands on me. And like I said, I tend to be a pretty rational, not particularly emotional, emotive member of the Blessed Company of All Faithful People, but I can't tell you how moved I was by this outpouring of care and affection from my people. My wife had come along this particular week to hear the talk and asked me how I felt about that, and I told her how shocked I was by my visceral reaction to it. Cheered, encouraged, cared about, lifted up, and reminded that congregational life is not walking your dog, however cool your dog may be. We weep for each other's losses, whoop with delight at each other's wins. Ideally, we can be who we really are with the people we accidentally wash up through the front doors here with. We need to rub up against each other in order not to be comfortable, but to be unashamed about being dented, a little scratched, because these are the natural things that come along with life in a complicated world. This thing that we're doing here is not a calculator where you feed data in at one end and you get the same answers from the same data every time. Sometimes in our lives, things don't add up, even when we think we're doing the right things. Unfair setbacks occur. The saints in our lives get way too much grief, while outrageous sinners skate. And so the rules, as we're taught them, and we do learn a lot of rules, we're taught these rules from the earliest days of religious instruction, they don't seem to neatly explain the world and the outcomes that we're told are unjust. You may be irritated at something you hear in a sermon that's just a little too neat, just too pat, that doesn't seem to be adequately getting at all the things you already see aren't adding up in your workplace or your city or this sad old world. That's where habit comes in, and I want to talk to you just a little bit about habit before I stop doing this. We tend in English to look down on, at least connotatively, the word habit. We're told things that we do out of habit, biting our nails or interrupting other people when they're talking, are things that we have to stop doing. We are warned against substances like medicines that may become what? Habit-forming. You may remember the classic rock ballad. I know some of you are boomers. The classic rock ballad, Peter Cetera of Chicago calls his love what? A hard habit to break. But the great mystery of the church is built on great big granite blocks of habit. Confession, absolution, weekly attendance, communion. It's the practice of hundreds of millions of people that gains enormous motive power from habit. You've heard the parable of the Good Samaritan before. You'll hear it again. Sacrificial love didn't mean much to me as a 12-year-old altar boy, but it sure means a lot to me now. After fatherhood and 45 years of marriage. God and Satan placing bets on how good old Job would respond to having his life destroyed as a test? That's wacky. I still want to hear it again and again and again. I know it's wacky, so I set that part aside and keep, like the popover of life, you eat the bread and spit out the hot air. You are here, and sometimes habit is all that gets you here. But then you hear something or ponder something of deep value and significance that you weren't expecting when you were dragging yourself out of the house this morning. And the way you were feeling about the whole enterprise just an hour ago doesn't matter anymore. Care for others is a habit. Kindness is a habit. The emotional muscles built and flexed by congregational life are deeply tied to habit. And there's no apology necessary for that or sought. As they knew in the catacombs, as they knew in the basilicas of Europe, and in the newest Christian communities in the New World, habit works. It's deeply built into the structure of what we do. Doubt is okay. It's even essential, in my view. A vital test of what you've been told. The fire that burns away the impurities, leaving what's precious behind. But habit really needs another good look, because we kind of dismiss it as not a noble reason to do anything. Habit is fine. If habit inwardly raise your hand, you don't have to actually raise your hand. If habit is what got you here this morning, it's okay. I know we are urged to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's not a great slogan to build a big movement around because so few of us, even after all these years of trying, are perfect. But we know we're doing it right when we are clear with ourselves and each other about continuing imperfection that we're willing to work at in this ceaseless, long walk that we can't do alone and never have to. The habit we offer here is inevitably going to change as daily life continues to change at breakneck pace. The habit we offer has lots of upside. Stop biting your nails and you'll have nicer looking nails and less of a chance of grossing out the people who watch you do it. Stop smoking and your clothes won't smell and your teeth won't discolor and you have a demonstrable chance of living longer. Join our thing and you'll have a built-in crew to sing with you and wonder with you and pray with you, a place you don't have to be perfect or hard charging or sure of all the answers in order to be accepted. You'll have people who worry with you when you're sick and rejoice with your joy and weep when you die. And that may be sort of an abstract value. I mean, you'll be here, but not exactly in quite the same way. But it's cool to have people, to know that there are people who will weep when you die. So come back next week and the week after, and let's make this a habit. Thanks a lot. Thank you.